For our Halloween Read On, we played a clip of an interview I did with James Herbert back in 2013, shortly before he died. Because of time limitations, we could only play about 10 minutes of the interview, but there's no time limit online, so here's the whole interview, taken from a very special edition of Talking Books.
Swish, thwack, louder, swish, thwack, louder, coming closer, swish, thwack, almost becoming one sound. They tried to be very, very quiet.
When I spoke to James Herbert, we chatted about his childhood in London in the 40s and how it has influenced his work, in particular his first novel, The Rats.
I've got two older brothers, and my eldest used to take us to Bethnal Green, to Aldgate, well, Commercial Road, to Dalston. And this was in a time where films weren't, several films on at the same time, but they would play old films as well. And I saw one or two X films, X-rated, later on. Before that, they were H-rated, H for horror, and then they became X. So we used to get in the back way to see a lot of these films. And in the street where I lived, at Aldgate, near Whitechapel, it was a very spooky house. In fact, it was a condemned building. The street itself was quite spooky. In those days, it was one of the last streets in London to have gas lighting inside and outside in the streets. I used to watch the old guy come along on his bike every evening at 6 and every morning about 4 to switch them off. He had a long pole and he just snuffed them out. There was a small alleyway 2 doors away from where I lived where Jack the Ripper used to use as a means of getting away from the police, as legend goes. Half the street was bombed buildings, which were lots of rats. Behind us was Petticoat Lane, again, lots of rats. Our house was a condemned building. We had 2 cats to keep the rats away. Although one day, having Sunday lunch, our cat, which was a mean streak of a cat, I loved it, you know, didn't even have a name. He jumped through the window with a rat in its mouth, you know. And the other cat was more lazy, very fluffy cat. And in fact, you know, the whole street we lived in, there are a lot of people that worked in Petticoat Lane, because all those people in those houses, these condemned buildings that were due to be knocked down after the war, their houses inside were immaculate.
And the prologue to Rats tells us about such a house.
The old house had been empty for more than a year. It stood detached and faded next to a disused canal away from the road, screened by foliage gone wild. No one went there, nobody showed much interest anymore. A few windows had been shattered by the neighbourhood kids, but even they lost interest when nothing more than silence responded to the crash of broken glass. In fact, the only interest that had ever been shown by others was on the day they took the old woman away. They knew she'd been living alone since her husband had died, never went out, and was only rarely seen peering from behind lace curtains. She never parted the curtains, just gazed through them, so only a hazy, spectral form could be seen by anyone interested enough to look. Her groceries were delivered every week and left on the back step. Powdered milk was included amongst them. The local grocer said the old woman's bank paid her bills regularly every 3 months, with never any queries as to the contents of his delivery, which suited him. He'd been given a list at the beginning for a regular order, but if he forgot to include a pound of butter or 2 pounds of sugar now and again, no one noticed. No one complained. Still, he was curious. He used to see her occasionally when her husband was alive, but even then she didn't have much to say. They were a couple of queer old birds, her and her old man, never going out, never having company, but well off because they'd been abroad for years, and since their return the husband never seemed to work. Then the old boy had died. The grocer wasn't sure of what, but it had been a recurrence of some tropical disease he'd caught whilst abroad. The old woman was never seen after that, but the grocer had heard her. Nothing much, just the scraping of chairs or a door closing. He'd once heard her shouting at someone, but never discovered who. People had begun to wonder about her. Some heard wailing coming from the house one night, laughter another. Finally, complete silence for over a month. It was only when the grocer found his previous week's delivery still on the doorstep that he reluctantly reported the matter to the police. Reluctantly, because he feared the worst, and hated to see a nice little regular order come to an end. Anyway, it turned out she wasn't dead. A policeman was sent to investigate, and then an ambulance arrived and took her away. She wasn't dead. Just a lunatic. As far as the grocer was concerned, she might just as well have passed on, because that was the end of his little number. It had been too good to last. So the house was empty. Nobody came, nobody went, nobody really bothered. In a year, it was barely visible from the road. The undergrowth was tall, the bushes thick, and the trees hid the upper story. Eventually, people were hardly aware it existed.
That was the prologue to The Rats Read by Gareth Armstrong. Now, before that clip, we were talking about a very spooky house.
Inside, the walls were all made of wood. And every summer and every winter, you heard creaks and cracks of the wood expanding or, you know, shrinking. And it was a frightful place, really. And I was on my own a lot, because my thing in those days was reading and drawing. And I was always indoors drawing away, you know, and the lights would go out. And I would have to go down to this basement cellar, which had no light. And it was a coal bunker as well. And I had to climb over the coal to reach the electric meter and put a shilling in and using a match for light. Now, that was if I had a shilling. And if I could find any matches, because I never went in down there when it was totally dark. But so I was often find myself sitting alone in the dark.
Now, you've talked about being alone in the house and how that's influenced some of your work.
Well, my brothers, they were, as I said, they were older than me and they were always out. And my parents, particularly my mother, she worked hard all day, and Fridays and Saturdays and Sundays she liked to go out and have a drink and just enjoy herself, you know, never too much. The old man was, you know, the one who had too much. But there I was, always left alone, you know, and you know, the whole streets played havoc with my mind. Well, let's just say it was ingrained in my mind.
Now, moving on, when you were younger, you weren't just left alone in the house.
I was always being sent away to what they call the Country Holiday Fund. That's where poor kids in inner cities, and for us it was the East End of London, who had never seen the sea before, never seen a cow, and there were charities they're still going today. It's called the Country Holiday Fund. And we were always sent away there. And quite often, it used to be me and my middle brother, usually, but quite often I was sent to homes on my own. Because I was very, I was the runt of the litter, shall we say. I was a skinny kid, and I needed fresh air and grass around me. So I was often sent away to the country to live in foster homes, which I hated. I thoroughly hated. And some were not just foster homes, they were proper homes, as in Crickley Hall, which was where that came from. They were just horrible. And the worst thing of all was, it always happened on the last day. I remember the last day in this particular home that was in Broadstairs, which I've never been back to since. I just hated the place. It was just horrible. And I made my bed, and I was whistling, and I was happy. And the principal came in and said, Herbert, I've just got your mother on the phone, and she said, can we keep you for another week or two? And I just sat down on the bed and cried, because I was meant to be going home that day. I'd already packed. And my best pal there, he went into the principal and said, look, Jimmy's he's crying, he's really upset. And I don't know if the guy... No, my mother must have still been on the phone, because we didn't have a phone ourselves. She was in a call box. And she told the principal told her this, and he came back and said, okay, Herbert, you're going home today. And, my whole world brightened again. But can you imagine, I was about 6 years old, six or seven, and, the disappointment, the utter disappointment of looking forward to your home. And I was a real home boy. I loved home. And then to be told, no, you had a couple of more weeks of doing time. I'm saying that. I mean, I was never sent away for being bad or naughty. It was always on health reasons, and to put some weight on me, which is only beginning to work today. I think it's called a pot belly.
You took that experience and exaggerated it, or at least I hope you exaggerated it, for The Secret of Crickley Hall. Here's a clip narrated by Sean Barrett.
They heard his approach, even though he wore no shoes, for he swished something through the cold, damp air, each swish ending in a sudden, violent thwack, the beating of cane against bare flesh. Swish, then thwack, cane on flesh. Swish, then thwack, two individual sounds that could be clearly heard over the raging storm outside. Swish, thwack, louder, swish, thwack, louder, coming closer, swish, thwack, almost becoming one sound. They tried to be very, very quiet.
Sean Barrett narrating the prologue to The Secret of Crickley Hall. That's recently been adapted by the BBC. Now, you've been protective of your work, even demanding that the font be changed in your book, Fluke. How hard is it to give up your story to someone else?
I've only just learned to do it, because I've had five films now, and I would say three of those have been a huge disappointment, because they moved away from the book itself, but too far away. One of the last ones was called Haunted, and that had a great cast, Kate Beckinsale, Sir John Gielgud, the late Adam Massey, Aidan Quinn was the American actor we had in it, and it was directed by Lewis Gilbert, who did Educating Rita and Shirley Valentine, as well as, a couple of James Bond movies. So he was well established in the business. But we talked, and talked, and I tried to get him to change things. But it was all, oh, well, we can change it on a day, darling, don't worry. But of course, he just does exactly what he wants. Now, on Crickley Hall, there's a young man called Joe Ahern.
Mm-hmm.
And we met a couple of times, and he listened, and he took most into account. And I read the first script for the first episode, started reading the second, and thought, I can read no more. This is the time where it's no longer my vision. It's the director's vision. He has to make it work for the budget he's limited to, and for the BBC, for scenes that he's limited to. But it seems to have worked very well. I mean, I'm very pleased with it. And so is the BBC.
Now, do you think that's going to mean that there will be other adaptations of your work following?
I've no idea. You know, I get lots of offers, but the problem with my books, they usually end in a big climax, which for films, it costs money. And British films don't have that sort of money.
Mm.
Steve King has swallowed up all the movies in America, and quite rightly too. So it's very difficult, and I've been sent scripts and things, and they're disappointed me. But, you know, I'm still waiting for the right production company to come along.
I saw an early version of Rats. It was called,
Demonize,
that's
yeah.
it. But today with CGI effects, I mean, they used puppets and dogs
well,
and everything.
But do you know, I bought a DVD just a couple of months ago, and it was called The Rats.
Mm.
It was an exact takeoff of my book. But you see, there is no copyright on a name nor an idea. But they had all the latest CG effects, and it was a rotten film, but the effects were outstanding. And I just thought if we'd had it in the day, you know, when I made my film, well, we could have had quite a good film there. So, yeah, things have moved on. Another book I'd love to have of mine done is called The Fog. Now, there is a film out called Fog, and it's also been remade. But that's not my Fog. That's a director called John Carpenter, who happened by chance to be in England where my book came out. And I guess he thought that was a good title, because really, his story could have been called anything, because it was about dead pirates. So that would be a lovely one to make. I did try, but I just turned down the script. It was more like James Bond meets the Fog. But that was years ago. Another one is The Magic Cottage, which is one of my favourites. And I think they could make a great film of that. Fluke, which is another favourite of mine, and it's not a horror story. It's about a dog, or a man, who's reincarnated as a dog. And that was a good film, a very good film.
Mm.
Unfortunately, it was never released in theatres over here. It was in America. The DVD is out. But the Americans didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know if it was too dark for kids or not dark enough for adults. So they really didn't know how to market it. So, yeah, they've all been the kind of failures in terms of marketing. But I've done a lot more that things could be done with if only they make the effort.
Back to the writing, how does the actual the research affect you emotionally? I'm thinking about The Others, which is horrific tale in itself, but you mention in the book that it's based on real events.
Uh, yeah, she was a cook there, an assistant cook, and in her break she used to wander around the hospital, and she went to the top floor and found this unmarked ward, or I think you said very private, and inside were all toddlers and babies with big heads, no arms, strange features. Absolute, and I hate using the words, that's why the book was called Others rather than Freaks.
Mm.
And I got very emotionally involved in that because I know it still goes on. And these people are sort of, they're not brought out into the open. You know, they're left in a secret societies. You know, they're just hidden away. And in fact, that features in Ash, and it's to do with the royal family. And we learned recently, a few months back, that the Queen has two cousins that I think are autistic.
Mm.
Years ago, at the turn of the century, little Prince Johnny, who was autistic and had fits, he was hidden away. And the way I'd done it, he was sent up to this castle eventually in Scotland, where he eventually passed away. But you know, there are characters like that that have stayed there. I mean, Jack the Ripper is one. So these people that you wonder about and what happened, it resolves a few questions. Some are very well based on facts, but others are pure guesswork.
Yeah, there's someone's secret son staying there as well.
Yeah, but we won't go into that.
We have linked very nicely into your latest book, Ash, is why we're having this conversation in the first place. Because Ash is entering the Talking Books library. Now, it's described as your most controversial novel to date and will make you wonder what is fact and what is fiction. So what can we expect from Ash?
You can expect a lot of controversy, which I'm surprised that the press hasn't generally picked up on, because it gives away secrets about a lot of things that people have asked themselves, like what did happen to Lord Lucan, what happened in the Jeremy Thorpe case, how did a man get into the Queen's bedroom in Buckingham Palace, many, many questions like that. Did Robert Maxwell really die in the water of Spain? And they're all answered in the book. And what it is, it's a lot of research, a lot of investigation, but mainly it's creative thinking. So I supply your answer. Some is quite near to the truth. Other bits, you know, my own imagination.
Now, the setting is Comerich Castle, which I believe is based on a real place.
Oh, yes, it is, yeah. I chose it. It's in Scotland, and I chose it for its position because it's on a high clifftop where, you know, the Irish Sea is sort of beaten at its cliffs. And it looks very, very dramatic in a picture from that angle, from the sea. But actually, I went up there to stay there, and it was lovely. You know, it couldn't have been better. They do have guests. They allowed me to wander all over the place, including rooftops and basements. And it's just a fascinating place to write about. But people shouldn't go there expecting it to be like my castle.
Mm.
I had to change it quite a bit to make it more spooky, if you like. But it is a luxury. curious place in the book, and I guess in reality, at a very popular place, but I have not actually mentioned the name, the real name of the castle in the book, because I didn't want to attract too much attention to it.
Now, I'll beep out the name that I'm going to say, but is it Castle?
I'll give you no answers to that at all.
Just there are clues that point to that. Even the road they take to get to it, think, yeah, that's on the way. Has the
well,
tunnels.
You're obviously a Scotsman, so you know the area. But yeah, it's quite easy to find if you follow the clues in the book. But I still refrain from actually naming it.
Now, does Scotland itself make a nice, horrific background?
Oh, it's great. Yeah, I love Scotland. You know, I've been up there quite a few times. I use it for another book called Portent. And I spent days up there going through the hills and the mountains, staying at little inns. And then, of course, I've been there on holiday. In fact, the last time on holiday was with my children. No, I only had one daughter then. And I crashed the car on the way to the ferry, which was going to take me over to Skye.
Mm.
So I just left the car by the roadside and got a lift by two very accommodating gentlemen who took us all the way to the ferry. And they were going to Skye themselves and actually dropped us off at a door where we could make a phone call. So I've got very fond memories of Scotland, but it is a very dramatic place. And it's the last refuge, I believe, of wild cats, and which is why I use them in the books. They come down from the north, the Highlands, and they're drawn to this particular castle.
The book Ash is, of course, named for David Ash, detective of the paranormal. And in this book, he's sent to the mysterious Comeragh Castle, as we've said, secluded deep in the Scottish countryside, to investigate a strange high-profile case. A man has been found crucified in a room that was locked. The reports suggest that the clifftop castle is being haunted. Who or what is the reclusive hooded figure that Ash has seen from the window walking across the courtyard in the dead of night? And as you've just hinted at, what are the strange animal-like sounds that come from the surrounding woods? And why are the castle's inhabitants so reluctant to talk about what they have seen? And what Ash eventually discovers is truly shocking. Here's a clip read by Stephen Pacey.
The phony shelf cruising had led him from the back of the store to the large plate glass windows overlooking the busy street beyond, and from where he chose a final volume entitled Flat Earth News, which he opened and brought up close to his face as if absorbed. But every few minutes he would gaze distractedly through the windows as if considering the text, while in truth he was contemplating the impressive edifice of the Aldwych building at the end of the broad and bustling Kingsway. There was another entrance-exit in the discreet courtyard at the back of Bush House, but he had an associate covering that. A call to Twig Samsung would inform him if their mark had left the building that way. His pretended attention returned to the book again, and he turned a page, appearing to be engrossed in its warnings about the world's news media. Twig was a fastidious individual who had once enjoyed the subterfuge involved in surveillance and tracking, learning the mark's habits and regularly visited haunts. But these days he found the chase less agreeable, the long stakeouts tedious, the satisfaction coming only with the final dispatch.
Now, a couple of your audiobooks in the Talking Books library were narrated by Robert Powell. I believe at your request. What was the reason for that?
Oh, well, he's a mate of mine. You know, I mean, just by chance, he read one of mine, and it was just very good. I forget, it was one of the early ones. And we met a couple of times at parties and dinner parties and got on very well. And we kind of had a handshake deal that if it was possible, if he was free, he would would do all my books.
Mm.
Unfortunately, the last couple, I think, he was on tour. You know, he's a very busy actor. So he couldn't do them. But I'm still quite pleased with the voices that we have used.
Now, how important are audiobooks to you and the fact that your books are available to everyone?
To me personally, they're very important because, I mean, I spend the whole day looking at words on a page or making up words for a page. I also read all the time. I've always got a book on the go. And then when I go to bed at night, I usually, if there's a film on, I'll watch the film to, you know, 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. And then I will put on an audio book that usually, after 10 minutes or so, puts me to sleep. But on a Sunday morning or a Saturday morning, when I tend nowadays to have a lay-in, I put a tape on. So that's very important to me. It's important as far as the public is concerned because it's, you know, my work reaching another part of the public, say people that are blind. I mean, some have been set in Braille. I'm not sure horror is the right thing if you can't see. You know, your imagination must run amok. But they do seem to be on demand. And, I mean, we've done a lot of audio cassettes, and some, when asked, for charity, but a lot, you know, just on sale. I think they're with audio books at the moment. Audio Go, sorry. So, yeah, and to me, it's almost like my mother telling me a story before, when she put me to bed at night when I was a kid. That had to stop when I was 18, but I'm kidding there, Robert. No, but when I was a toddler, she always read me stories, and she used to come down to, when I got married, to my house, and used to come down to the house and read to my children, or more importantly, make up stories. She had that kind of creative mind, although there was always a little girl called Rosie in it, you know, and it usually centered around this little cottage in the country with flowers, roses around the door, little garden path, you know, miles from anywhere, but just very sweet, very quaint. And that was her way of escaping the East End of London, which, you know, we had a rough time. You know, I'm not complaining. It makes me appreciate what I've got now. But, yeah, she was great, and she's always telling stories. And all my mates, they loved her because she'd tell them true stories, and she was always funny, you know. She told me stories about my father, or the old man, as I used to call him. He is now dead. But he was a bit of a bruiser. He looked a bit like Humphrey Bogart. He was a legend in Bethnal Green Road, where he had a stall selling fruit and veg, and his father before him had the same. And he was always getting into some kind of mischief, or should we call it trouble. But she would tell it in a way that had you rolling in your seat, you know. And that's where I think I got a lot of my humour from. There's some humour that I use in the books, quite a lot, in fact. But, you know, the scare tactics sort of overweigh any sort of humour. But, yeah, I do have a very large streak of humour in me.
James Herbert, thank you so much for joining me on today's Talking Books.
Thank you very much, Robert, and I hope your listeners enjoy the stories.